He understood my questions. His memory was clear about going into the pool with the victim. He remembered and quickly provided the clothing he had on that night. His perception was that the victim was asleep in the pool. Of course, that suggests that Carrie Dowling was dead when he arrived on the scene. But he also said that when he asked Carrie to wake up, she said, "I can't." If that's literally true, she was still alive. Could she have been in the pool injured when she said, "I can't"? No. She had sustained a massive traumatic blow to the back of the head. She would have lost consciousness immediately before she even hit the water.
All right. So what is your gut regarding Jamie Chapman?
His answers amounted to mixed signals. I asked him if he hit Carrie, and he said no. He said that Big Guy hurt Carrie, and his father called him Big Guy. I tried to pin him down on whether there was another Big Guy at the scene, but I just couldn't get a clear answer. So whether he saw somebody else do it or did it himself, I just don't know.
So where does that leave us with Alan Crowley, who this office arrested?
Mike answered,
"One thing Jamie was specific about is that he saw Alan Crowley hug the victim and then leave."
Artie, almost sounding defensive, spoke.
"Boss, almost everything pointed to Alan Crowley, and that is why we recommended that you approve his arrest. The latest developments give us great concern as to whether or not he was the killer."
The chagrin on Matt Koenig's face was evident, as the enormity of the arrest of possibly the wrong person sunk in.
"What we need to do is find out everything we can about Jamie Chapman," Artie said. "School records, behavior incidents, any signs of violence. As a special ed student, he would have had an IEP, an individual education plan. Let's get that, see what it says, and talk to the teachers he had along the way."
Koenig said,
"You know that will require another court order."
"I know,"
Artie said.
"And you know Chapman's lawyer could fight us every step of the way. But you know, ironically, he might agree to let us have these records if he thinks they will help his client."
"All right," Artie said. "I'll get in touch with Greg Barber and see what his position is."
The morning following the court hearing and the press firestorm, Artie Shulman, Matt Koenig, and Mike met again. The three men knew that they had come to an impasse. The once almost ironclad case against Alan Crowley was collapsing. Jamie Chapman, while probably not the killer, could not be completely ruled out. He had spoken about a big guy hurting Carrie, and they didn't know if he was referring to himself or someone else. Both Crowley and Chapman had attorneys who had directed that there would be no more interviews of their clients. And the nagging loose end about the driver who had changed Carrie's flat tire still lingered. Koenig was correct in his prediction that Greg Barber would not oppose their receiving copies of Jamie's school records. Barber had just gone through the set he had received from Jamie's schools. He had his secretary copy and deliver them to the prosecutor's office. The records showed, as they'd expected, a young man with severe cognitive impairment. They also revealed a history in school of being compliant and friendly, and with no hint of violence or aggressive behavior. They all agreed that they were not at the point of requesting to a court that the criminal complaint against Alan Crowley be dismissed. Matt Koenig somberly added that he would contact Lester Parker and tell him that he would agree that the electronic bracelet be removed and the travel restrictions outside New Jersey be lifted. He knew this wouldn't placate Parker for long, but he would tell him that's as far as he was willing to go now. Koenig ended the meeting by saying,
"I know we're all doing our utmost to solve this case. We just have to take the heat that comes with it."
66. It had been 2.5 weeks since Carrie's death. A sad sense of finality was settling in. Aline made an effort to be home most nights by 6:30. She wanted to be there to have a glass of wine with her mother. She believed that their chats brightened Fran's spirits. But tonight, when she came in, it was obvious that her mother was having a very dark day. Her eyes were swollen. She was sitting in the living room, sifting through a family photo album. When Fran saw her come in, she looked up, but left the book open.
"Do you remember how Carrie broke her ankle when she was 11?
I kept warning and warning her. She was a good ice skater, but she couldn't do those twirls the way she wanted to. But she always kept on trying.
I remember, Aline said. I was never any good at ice skating.
No, you weren't, her mother agreed. You were always the great student. Carrie was the great athlete.
I think it's time for a glass of wine, Aline suggested as she lifted the photo album off her mother's lap.
Fran closed her eyes.
I guess so, she said indifferently.
Aline went to the kitchen and called out, Something smells really delicious in here.
It's veal parmesan. I thought it would taste good for a change.
Aline did not have to be reminded that veal parmesan had been Carrie's favorite. She came back with the two glasses of wine and turned on several more lights.
Brighten the corner where you are, she said.
I'm surprised you know that song. It's an old gospel favorite.
Mom, I don't know the song. I do know that every time you turn on a light, you say that.
Fran smiled a real smile.
I guess I do.
Then she added,
Aline, I don't know what your father and I would have done if you had stayed in London.
I would have come straight home.
I know you would have.
Now let's change the subject. How was school today?
I told you how all the seniors are fixated on which colleges to apply to. When it comes to writing the essays, some of them have a natural ability. They can effortlessly tell a story. For others, every word on the page is a struggle.
The sound of the front door opening announced Steve's arrival. He walked into the living room, looked at their glasses of wine, and said,
I guess it's 5 o'clock somewhere in the world.
He leaned over and put his arms around Fran.
How are you doing?
Today was rough. I was out running errands and drove past the high school. The girls' soccer team was practicing. It got me thinking.
I know. I make it a point to not drive past the high school. Is there any wine left, or did you two drink it all?
I'll get you one, Dad, Aline said.
When Aline was in the kitchen, the doorbell rang.
Are we expecting anyone?
Steve asked as he got up.
No, Fran told him.
As Aline walked back into the living room with her father's glass of wine, Steve came into the room with Scott Kimball at his side.
What is he doing here?
Aline asked herself.
Hi, Scott. This is a surprise. You've obviously met my father.
This is my mother, Fran.
Mom, this is Scott Kimball.
I know who he is, Fran said. Scott was Carrie's lacrosse coach.
Scott, anything to drink?
Steve asked.
I'll join you folks in a white wine if that's okay. Take that one, Steve said, pointing to the glass in Aline's hand. I'll get myself another.
Do sit down, Fran said.
And why not take your shoes off, Aline thought.
So, Scott, she asked. What brings you over?
Aline, I tried to phone you. I guess your phone was off. This afternoon a friend of mine called me. He's heartbroken. He has 2 tickets for Hamilton tomorrow night, but he has to leave in the morning on a business emergency and gave them to me. I was hoping you might be free.
Oh, Aline, how wonderful, Fran said. Your father and I have been dying to see that show.
Aline wondered if there was any way she could persuade Scott to give the tickets to her parents. She hesitated, trying to find a way to say no. Fran answered for her.
Oh, Aline, of course you'll go. Everyone raves about that show.
Steve said,
Scott, that is so nice of you.
Aline knew she really wanted to see Hamilton. She just didn't like the idea of spending a third evening with Scott Kimball. She really resented the fact that he had just walked in. Before she could answer, her mother said,
Scott, do you like veal parmesan?
I love veal parmesan, but I don't want to intrude. Anyone who comes bearing 2 tickets to Hamilton certainly is not intruding, Steve said heartily. Right, Aline?
There was nothing she could do but say,
Of course not.
Scott was seated in the chair opposite her, where Carrie used to sit. At dinner, he brought up the subject of his family.
I was raised in Nebraska. My mother and father are still there. So are my grandparents. I spend all the holidays with them. But as I mentioned to Aline, I love to travel. Most summers I'm on the road.
We go on a river cruise once a year with friends, Fran said. I thoroughly enjoy them. Last year it was the Danube. The year before that, the Seine.
A river cruise is next on my list, Scott said. Which line did you use?
Aline was quiet through dinner. Next thing you know, he'll say he has 2 tickets to a river cruise, she thought. Plan on inviting somebody else. Over coffee, she wondered why she resented Scott so much. She had not intended to go out with him a second time, but she had to admit she had enjoyed herself. She appreciated how concerned he was about Valerie. Aline did not want to be manipulated into a dating situation. She would finish dinner tonight, go to Hamilton tomorrow, and then that would be it. Period. Then the thought of Mike came into her mind. If he had come in with those tickets, she would have been delighted to say yes. She knew she was right when the next night, after seeing Hamilton, Scott drove her home and walked her to the door. As she fished her key from her purse, he suddenly put his arms around her and kissed her.
I'm falling in love with you, Aline, he said. Make that have fallen in love with you.
She broke away from the embrace and put her key in the lock, turned it, and opened the door. Do us both a favor. Don't, she said emphatically, as she stepped in and closed the door behind her. Mike was barely in his office when Investigator Sam Hines knocked on the half-open door.
Mike, I think I might have something on that tow truck driver we're looking for.
Mike waved him in, pointing to a chair opposite his desk.
What have you got? It's a bit of a fluke I found this because I wasn't even looking for it. I've been researching drivers who work for the tow truck companies that have permits to operate in local municipalities. So far, nothing interesting has turned up. But these companies aren't the only ones that own tow trucks. Junkyards typically have one to retrieve wrecks.
That makes sense.
So that's what made this arrest report from the Lodi Police Department so interesting.
Hall began summarizing.
24-year-old Edward Dietz was arrested 3 hours ago and charged with possession of cocaine and drug paraphernalia. He was stopped on Route 17 for speeding and passing on the right. The tow truck he was driving was registered to Ferranda Brothers, an auto salvage company in Munaki. Here's where it gets interesting. I'm reading about this guy they arrested, and my phone rings. It's Patrolman Sandy Fitchett from the Lodi Police Force. Fitchett was aware of the BOLO we put out on the tow truck driver.
Mike knew that BOLO was shorthand for Be On The Lookout For.
Fitchett says they've been holding this guy while doing an outstanding warrants check, and he has several. Failure to appear in court for a traffic infraction, he's behind in child support, and he had an assault charge against him dropped 3 months ago for trying to kiss a woman he had helped in the Woodbury Commons Mall parking lot when her car wouldn't start.
Why was it dropped?
The victim was from out of state. She didn't show up to testify.
How old was the victim?
17.
So he likes hitting on young women. He offers to help them and then he tries to take advantage. Nice work, Sam. I want to have a talk with our good Samaritan right now.
I had a feeling you would, Hines said. Fitchett is at the station waiting for you. Dietz is still in their holding cell.
As Mike inched along on Route 17 South, he was fervently hoping that this tow truck driver would be the one who had the encounter with Carrie. On the other hand, he could only imagine the field day the press would have if it was revealed that the prosecutor's office had a third independent suspect in the Dowling murder.
Don't get ahead of yourself,
he thought.
Odds are this isn't the guy we're looking for.
When he finally arrived at the Lodi police station, the desk sergeant pointed him to a room where patrolman Sandy Fitchett was seated at a table. Several clear plastic bags were on top of it. One contained a wallet, a pocket knife, and keychain. Another was stuffed with papers.
As it turned out, patrolman Fitchett was patrolwoman Fitchett.
She stood up, extended her hand, and introduced herself. Mike guessed Fitchett was in her mid to late 20s. She briefed Mike on the circumstances under which she had pulled over and arrested Dietz.
I'm just starting to go through his personal effects, she said, as she spilled the contents of one of the bags out on the table.
That is one really fat wallet,
Mike observed.
Do you mind if I go through it?
Be my guest, Sandy said, as she started to open another bag filled with papers.
What are all those?
Mike asked, referring to the bag in front of Sandy.
This stuff was in his truck. The crack pipe was resting on top of it. Just want to see if there's anything interesting.
Obviously you searched his truck. How did you get a warrant so quickly?
Didn't need one. It's not Dietz's truck. It's registered to Ferranda Brothers. I spoke to the owner. After assuring me that anything I find in the truck doesn't belong to him, he gave me permission to search.
What is your impression of Dietz?
I'm right in the middle of reading him his rights while I'm arresting him, and this jerk starts telling me how beautiful I am. What a creep.
Mike smiled as he listened. Dietz's wallet was so thick, Mike wondered if it would fit in his back pocket. He began taking out pieces of paper and sorting them into piles. Wendy's, Dunkin' Donuts, and McDonald's receipts, gas and ShopRite receipts, a traffic summons from 2 weeks ago, a receipt from a motorcycle repair shop, several business cards, including one from a doctor and two from attorneys. Mike knew one of the lawyers whose office was in East Rutherford. His attention was suddenly riveted by a torn envelope with a phone number scribbled on it. Sandy must have noticed his expression change.
Mike? What is it?
Without answering, he pulled his notebook from his pocket and flipped the pages. He glanced back at the number on the torn envelope. A grim smile came over his face.
Pay dirt,
he said.
The number on this piece of paper that came from Dietz's wallet is the cell phone number of Carrie Dowling. He's the guy we've been looking for.
Mike, when you question Dietz, mind if I watch from the other room?
Not at all.
While waiting in another meeting room for Dietz to be brought in, Mike phoned Artie Shulman. The assistant prosecutor insisted Mike call him immediately after he questioned Dietz. The door opened, and Sandy Fitchett had her hand on Dietz's elbow as she escorted him into the room. He was wearing faded, greasy blue jeans and scuffed work boots. His oil-stained gray T-shirt had a small tear by the right shoulder and the logo of an engine company on the front. His hands were cuffed in front of him. His bare arms showed the telltale welts of recent needle marks. He settled into the folding chair opposite Mike. Dietz was about 5'10" with a crew cut. Despite the fact that he was unshaven and the darkness under his eyes, his features were handsome.
Mr. Dietz, my name is Mike Wilson. I'm a detective with the Bergen County Prosecutor's Office.
My name is Eddie Dietz, but you probably already know that. It's an honor to meet you, detective,
he said sarcastically.
Okay, Eddie. I don't want to take up too much of your valuable time, so let's cut to the chase. Let me begin by saying I have zero interest in your recent speeding ticket, your drug arrest, your outstanding warrants, and your overdue child support. I hope I didn't leave anything out. I'm here to talk about one of my cases involving a young woman. Do you know a Carrie Dowling?
Dietz paused for a moment.
No, that name doesn't ring a bell. Maybe this will help,
Mike said, as he pulled a picture of Carrie out of an envelope and slid it across the table in front of Dietz. He stared at it, then looked up at Mike and said,
Sorry, don't know her.
You said you don't know her. Are you saying you never met her?
Dietz shook his head.
All right, Eddie, let's see if I can improve your memory. The girl in the picture is 18-year-old Carrie Dowling. 2.5 weeks ago, after having her high school friends over for a beer party, she was found dead in the swimming pool in her backyard.
Oh, yeah. I think I might have seen something about that case on TV.
Mike pulled a bag from under his chair and laid it on the table. Pointing to the wallet in the bag, Mike asked,
Is that yours?
It looks like mine.
It is yours, Eddie. And the papers stuffed inside the wallet, they're yours too, aren't they?
Maybe.
Eddie, I want to know about this piece of paper,
he said as he put the torn envelope on the table in front of him.
It's somebody's phone number. So what?
Eddie, let's cut the crap. About a week before she died, you were on Route 17 in Mahwah.
You pulled over and changed a flat tire for Carrie Dowling. You made arrangements with her to provide the alcohol for her upcoming party, a party you wanted to be invited to. You even asked her if you could come by after the party. When she said no, you tried to force yourself on her.
I didn't force anything. She wanted it.
Oh, I'm sure she did, Eddie. Just like the girl at Woodbury Commons. A good-looking guy like you helps her get her car started. She just wanted to show her appreciation.
That's right.
Eddie, much as I would love to nail you for groping Carrie after you delivered the alcohol and providing alcohol to a minor, I can't do that. The only witness, Carrie Dowling, is dead. Murdered. But that's not the end of the story with you and Carrie, is it? Later that night, you...
Wait a minute! You don't think I...
Yes, Eddie, I think you went back to her house after the party. Maybe you were a little drunk or high. When she refused your advances, you got really angry and killed her.
Eddie was breathing hard. His eyes, which were dull and listless earlier, were now sharp and focused.
The day she died. That was Saturday night?
Saturday, August 25th, Mike replied. The same day you gave her the beer and asked if you could come to the party.
Okay, I admit it. When I brought her the beer, I asked about going to the party. But I can prove I didn't go to her house that night.
How? Where were you?
Mike demanded.
I drove down to Atlantic City that night. I stayed at the Tropicana. I gambled most of the night.
What time did you get to the Tropicana?
I checked in around 10 o'clock.
Mike quickly did the math. Atlantic City was 140 miles from Saddle River. Even if Dietz was really pushing it, it would have taken him over 2 hours to get there. If he murdered Carrie at 11:15, the earliest he could have gotten to the Tropicana was about 1:30 a.m.
In that garbage pail that you call a wallet, I didn't see a receipt for the Tropicana.
I don't save everything.
Did you drive to Atlantic City?
Yes.
Alone?
Yes.
Whose car?
Mine.
Do you have an Easy Pass?
Not since I lost my credit card. I pay cash for my tolls.
How did you pay for your hotel room?
Cash.
Okay, Eddie. I'm gonna check out your Tropicana story. I know where to find you if I need you.
As Mike walked quickly toward the door, the desk sergeant called out to him.
Detective, Officer Fitchett asks if you could wait a few minutes. She wants to talk to you before you leave.
Okay,
Mike said as he moved over to a chair and sat down. He dialed Artie Shulman, who picked up on the first ring.
Artie, I'm still at the Lodi police station. The guy they picked up is the tow truck driver we've been looking for. He's claiming he was in Atlantic City at the time of the murder. I'm checking his story.
Good work. I'll ask if we have any contacts here that can move things along more quickly. Keep me posted.
Out of the corner of his eye, Mike spotted Sandy Fitchett heading toward him with a piece of paper in her hand. She took the seat next to him.
I just spoke to my uncle, Herb Phillips. He's a lieutenant with the state police in South Jersey. He works closely with security people at the casinos. Uncle Herb said he and the Tropicana's director of security can meet you or one of your people tomorrow morning at 10 to look at surveillance footage. Here are their phone numbers.
I'm in court tomorrow morning. I can't go myself. I'll send one of my investigators. I owe you a dinner.
Thanks so much,
Mike said as he hurried out to his car. His first call was to Sam Hines. After briefing him on the Dietz questioning, Mike said,
Set your alarm. You need to be in Atlantic City by 10 o'clock. Call Artie and fill him in.
Mike was in his office the next morning doing paperwork. A delay at the trial had pushed his testimony to the afternoon. When his phone rang at 11:30, the ID screen showed Tropicana Hotel. He picked it up.
Sam, what have you got?
Reservations records show a single room for the night of August 25th, booked by a Mr. Edward Dietz. The room was paid for in advance, with cash. Security footage shows a young white male who I'm absolutely certain is Dietz, entering the hotel at 9:49 p.m. There's more footage I can go through from inside the casino, but...
Don't bother,
Mike said.
If he's in AC at almost 10, There's no way he's back in Saddle River at 11:15. Thank the guys down there for me.
Mike hung up the phone and exhaled. He was not looking forward to telling Assistant Prosecutor Artie Shulman and Prosecutor Matt Koenig that once again their only suspects in the Dowling murder were Alan Crowley and Jamie Chapman. Marina Long had begun to worry about whether she should give up her job. She had always had a flair for fashion and had gone to work at a dress shop in nearby Ridgewood. She had an innate sense for helping customers choose the right style for their body type and personality. She already had a number of regular customers. It was a job she had found shortly after she moved to New Jersey. She liked it, and it paid reasonably well. But now her concern about Valerie had deepened. Her daughter's mood over the last few days was even more somber. She was even more detached, if that were possible. The change convinced Marina she should be there in the afternoons when her daughter got home from school. Everything she said to Valerie seemed to upset her. Marina decided that it would be better to bring up the subject by saying, "I've decided I want a job with different hours, and I'm going to start looking around." As usual, Valerie's response was, "Whatever," dismissing the subject. On Friday morning, when Valerie didn't come down the stairs to breakfast, Marina went up to her room. Valerie was in bed, curled up in a fetal position, sound asleep. An instinctive sense that something was wrong made Marina rush to her bedside. A prescription jar was on the night table. The cap was off. Marina picked it up. It was her prescription for Ambien, the sleep aid she used occasionally. The jar was empty. She shook Valerie's shoulder and flipped her over onto her back as she called her name. She did not stir. Marina looked down at her. She was very pale, and her lips were blue. Her breathing was shallow.
"Oh my God, no!"
she screamed as she grabbed the phone and dialed 911. 69. Fran and Steve left for Bermuda before lunch on Friday morning. They had decided to extend their trip to a full week. Aline was glad that her mother agreed to the extension. She could see that Fran was getting more and more depressed and desperately needed to get away. When she returned home from work on Friday, she remembered to bring in the mail. She stopped at the box at the end of the driveway, pulled it out, and dropped it on the kitchen table. An envelope addressed to Ms. Carrie Dowling caught her eye. It was from MasterCard. Aline remembered her parents giving her a credit card just before she had left for college.
"For emergencies only," her father had said with a smile, knowing his idea of what constituted an emergency would differ from hers.
They must have done the same for Carrie. Ordinarily, she would have left the envelope for them. With her parents away, she decided to open it. There were only two entries on the bill. ETD, a tire service center. That had to have been the new tire Dad had told Carrie to get, Aline thought. The second entry was for Coach House, a diner in Hackensack. The charge was $22.79. That's odd, Aline thought. There are diners in Waldwick and Park Ridge, both a lot closer to Saddle River. Why did Carrie go all the way to Hackensack? When she looked at the date Carrie had gone to the diner, her eyes widened. It was August 25th, the day of her party, the day she had been murdered. Aline pulled out her cell phone and opened her text messages file. The text about something very important was sent to her at 11:02 a.m. on the same day. She looked at the bill again. Almost $23 is a lot for one person. Carrie might have met somebody for breakfast and picked up the check. Shortly thereafter, she sent me the text. Could there be a connection? Carrie went to the diner on a Saturday morning. Tomorrow is Saturday. Odds are the same waitstaff will be there, including whoever waited on Carrie. Who could she have met? Maybe it was Alan. Or if it was one of Carrie's girlfriends, maybe one of the girls on the lacrosse team. I want to talk to her. Aline went to her computer. She opened Carrie's Facebook page and began to print some of the photos. This might be a waste of time, she thought, but it could be important to know what Carrie was doing the last day she was alive. The thought that she might have a chance to discover what was very important kept Aline up most of the night. At 8:15, she got up, showered, and dressed. By 8:45, she was in her car headed toward the coach house. She had skipped her usual light breakfast and coffee. They might be more talkative if I have breakfast there. She was happy to see that there were only a handful of cars in the parking lot. Two waiters were serving those eating at the counter. Aline looked around. If Carrie was having a private conversation with somebody, she would have chosen a table for two as far away from the other diners as possible. Probably one of the tables to the right or to the left that are up against the windows. The man behind the register asked,
"How many in your party?"
"Just one," she said. "I'd like a table over by the window."
"Sure," he said. "Sit anywhere you want."
A minute after she was seated, a waitress came over carrying a menu.
"Can I start you with coffee, honey?"
"Absolutely." Aline opened the folder that contained the pictures she had printed. When the waitress returned with the coffee, Aline said, "Obviously you work on Saturdays. Were you working on Saturday, August 25th in the morning?" The waitress considered.
"Let me see, that was 3 weeks ago?
Yes, I was back from vacation. I worked that Saturday."
"My sister ate here that Saturday morning. She met somebody for breakfast. I'm trying to find out who she met. Would you mind looking at some pictures?"
"Sure,"
she said. Aline spread several pictures on the table.
"That girl," the waitress said, "looks real familiar. I know I've seen her."
She was pointing at Carrie. "That's my sister," Aline said.
"Oh my God," the waitress gasped. "Is she the poor girl who got murdered in the pool?"
"I'm afraid so," Aline said quietly.
"I waited on them that day. They sat at the same table you're sitting at right now."
The waitress leaned over and stared at one picture after another. She then studied the photo of the lacrosse team and pointed her finger.
"That's her. That's the one who was crying."
She was pointing at Valerie. Marge was surprised when the phone rang as she was clearing the breakfast dishes. It was Gus Schreiber, Jamie's manager at Acme. Puzzled as to why he was calling, she immediately said,
"Oh, Mr. Schreiber, you have been so nice to Jamie. He loves working for you. I don't know what he would do if he didn't have his job at the Acme."
There was an uncomfortable silence. Then Schreiber said,
"Mrs. Chapman, that's why I'm calling you. At Acme, customers are our top priority. A number of them have come to me and expressed their concern about Jamie working in our store under the present circumstances. I hope you'll understand what I mean."
"No, I don't understand. Please explain to me what you mean."
"Mrs. Chapman, after what happened to Carrie Dowling, when Jamie is in the store, people are understandably nervous."
"Tell them they should worry about your other employee, that blabbermouth Tony Carter," Marge said fiercely. "You know damn well Jamie has always been a wonderful employee. That hasn't changed in the 2 years he's been with you. Now you want to fire him for no good reason. You should be ashamed of yourself."
"Mrs. Chapman, there are a lot of grocery stores around here where people can shop. I have to listen to the concerns of our customers."
"Even if it means being completely unfair to a very loyal employee. As soon as I get off the phone, I'm going to cut my Acme card in half. And let me tell you right now, Jamie has a very good lawyer, and he's going to hear about this conversation."
She slammed down the phone. Marge could hear Jamie's footsteps as he descended the stairs. He came down dressed for work.
"Mom, I'm going now. I'll see you later."
"Hold on, Jamie. I have to talk to you. Sit down, please."
"Mom, I don't want to be late. I punch in at work."
Marge scrambled to find the right words.
"Jamie, sometimes businesses like Acme don't have enough customers. When that happens, they have to tell some of the workers that they can't keep working there.
Does that mean they're going to fire some of my friends?
Yes, it does, Jamie. Not just some of your friends. You can't work there anymore either.
I can't work there? But Mr. Schreiber said I'm one of his best workers.
I know he did, and he's very sorry, Marge said with a grimace.
Jamie turned around and started toward the stairs. When he neared the top, Marge heard him burst into tears. Mike was in his condo late Saturday morning after he had run some errands. He did not relish the drive he would make to New Brunswick later this evening, but it was the only time the witnesses in another case could meet with him. He knew it was unprofessional for him to set up a meeting with Aline simply because he wanted to see her. He recalled one of his mother's favorite quotes, "The heart has reasons of which reason knows nothing." He remembered that ever since he was a child, his mother would say that if two unlikely people got together. The night before, he had been out to dinner with a woman he had dated casually but regularly while they were in law school. She was attractive and smart. He had enjoyed her company. But she had never given him the feeling he experienced when he was with Aline. He reminded himself that his job was to investigate the murder of a young woman. His interaction with the victim's family, including her sister, should be no more than what was necessary to pursue the case. Despite that, Aline Dowling was very much in his thoughts. He found himself trying to think of reasons related to the case that would make it appropriate for him to call her and suggest that they meet. Her image was always in his mind. Her hazel eyes, large with long lashes that framed them, sometimes seemed to reflect the color she was wearing. The first time they were out, she had on a violet-blue jacket with matching slacks that showed the elegance of her body and carriage. Sometimes she wore her hair loose around her shoulders. That was when her resemblance to Carrie was unmistakable. Other times her hair was caught up at the back of her head. Mike found himself trying to decide which way he liked it best. She had told him about her fiancé being killed by an intoxicated driver 4 years ago. He had the sense that there was no one in her life right now. Her heartfelt defense of Jamie Chapman showed her absolute loyalty to someone who was an active suspect in her sister's murder. In her talks with Carrie's friends, she was constantly trying to find any clue that might help the investigation find answers. Besides her reaction to the growing suspicions about Jamie Chapman, it was also clear to him that even though Alan Crowley was under arrest, Aline was not convinced that he was the killer. Whoever murdered Carrie had dealt her a vicious blow to the back of her head. If it was not Jamie or Alan, it meant that a third party who could do that to an 18-year-old girl would stop at nothing to escape detection. He knew that Aline was deeply concerned about a student who had been very close to Carrie and was now depressed. Aline had been careful to avoid referring to her by name, so Mike realized she would probably not say much about her to him. His cell phone rang, and he saw the name on the screen. He grabbed it and said,
"Hello, Aline."
"Mike, weeks ago you asked me to keep thinking about what Carrie was referring to when she texted that she had something very important to talk to me about. I might have made some progress."
"What is it, Aline?"
Mike asked quickly. "Carrie sent that text at 11:02 a.m. I saw on her credit card bill that she went to a diner that morning and met someone for breakfast. The waitress remembered Carrie clearly and said the girl she was with had been crying. I brought pictures of Carrie's friends. She immediately identified who was at the breakfast with Carrie."
"Who is it?"
"The name won't mean anything to you. It's Valerie Long. She's the one I told you about. She played on the lacrosse team with Carrie. From what I understand, Carrie had taken her under her wing, and she's heartbroken about Carrie's death. Judging from the time element, Carrie sent me that text very shortly after the breakfast ended."
"Do you have any idea what they spoke about?"
"No, but I'm going to find a reason to get Valerie into my office on Monday and see if she'll talk about it."
"Aline, if that girl said anything to Carrie that might have revealed something tied into her death, it could be very dangerous for you. My suggestion is that you call the girl into your office
Tell her that you know that she had breakfast that morning with Carrie, and try to make her understand that Carrie was going to tell you whatever it was that she and Valerie discussed. Tell her that Carrie intended to tell you about the conversation, and that Carrie would want her to share it with you at your meeting. We can talk about whether it makes sense for me to interview this girl.
That's what I want to do, Aline said. Thank you, Mike.
Aline, I've enjoyed the times we've had dinner together. When this case is over...
Yes, Aline interrupted. I want you to ask me out.
On Sunday morning, after the 10 o'clock mass, Aline had made breakfast and was enjoying the peace and quiet as she read the papers. She found herself putting off the work she had brought home from school.
One more cup of coffee, she thought, and then an hour at the gym, and then I'll plow through it.
As she was getting up from the table, the home phone rang. The caller ID showed private. She picked it up.
Aline Dowling, is that you?
Yes, it is. Who's calling?
Aline, this is Marina Long. I'm so sorry to call you at home, and I don't have your cell number.
Absolutely no problem, Marina. I was thinking about you and Valerie the other day. She wasn't in school on Friday. Is everything okay?
There was a pause before Marina answered.
No. Well, yes. Things are better now.
Marina, I can tell you're upset. What happened?
Valerie tried to take her life on Friday.
Oh my God! Is she all right?
Yes. I was in the hospital with her all day Friday. They kept her overnight. A hospital psychiatrist came and spoke to her the next morning. He said it was okay for us to bring her home. She slept most of yesterday and seems to be doing better today. I'm so worried about her. I think she might need to stay home and rest a few more days.
Marina, don't worry about that. I'll work things out with her teachers. Do you mind if I come to visit her? I can do it right now. I promise I'll only stay a few minutes.
I know how concerned you are. Of course. Stop over.
A ghostly pale Valerie was propped up on the couch in the den, with pillows behind her, a blanket covering her. Aline went over, hugged her, and pulled up a chair.
Valerie, we're all so worried about you. If anything had happened to you, our hearts would have been broken. I just want you to know that we love you dearly and want to help you in any way we can. If you ever need someone to talk to, I'm here for you.
Valerie looked at her.
Don't you understand? I can't talk to you,
she cried fiercely as she looked away. Aline went back home. As soon as she was in the door, she called Mike. Unable to reach him, she left a message about visiting Valerie after her suicide attempt. After returning from a jog around Schlegel Lake, Mike listened to his messages. He immediately tried to call Aline, who didn't pick up. He wasn't sure why, but every instinct told him that Carrie's breakfast meeting with Valerie was somehow linked to what would happen to Carrie that night.
Time is of the essence, he thought. Two suspects are twisting in the wind, waiting for this case to be resolved.
He searched online and found a listing, including the street address, for a long in Saddle River. There was only one. He called the colleague he wanted to come with him. Yes, she could meet him there later, if he was able to set it up. 20 minutes later, Mike's cell phone rang. It was Aline.
Sorry I missed your call. I left my phone at home when I went to the gym.
Aline, I'm getting very worried that Carrie's death may have had something to do with that breakfast meeting with Valerie at the diner. Especially since this kid has now tried to kill herself. I don't want to wait another minute. A female detective can meet me there. She is very sensitive and experienced. I'm asking you to call Valerie's parents and see if I can go to their home later today. They trust you. I think it would be better if you make the phone call.
I'll call right now and get right back to you.
10 minutes later, Aline called back.
Mike, it took a little persuading, because they feel Valerie is so fragile. They agreed that you could come at 6 tonight as long as you stop right away if she gets too upset.
Aline, thanks so much. I owe you a dinner. How about tonight? 7:30? 8 o'clock? I'll come straight from Valerie's.
We're on.
73. Looking forward to seeing Mike, Aline showered and went to her closet. She chose a navy blue silk blouse over fitted jeans. She had just finished her makeup when the phone rang. The name on the screen surprised her.
Hello, Mrs. Chapman.
Is this Aline Dowling?
Yes, it is.
Aline, my name is Brenda Niemeyer. I'm a close friend of Marge's. This is her phone. She asked me to call you.
Is Mrs. Chapman okay? Aline heard the woman fighting off tears as she spoke.
I'm over at Pascack Valley Hospital. It looks like Marge had a heart attack. She had instructions in her pocketbook that I should be called in an emergency and help make decisions if she can't.
Oh, my God, Aline said. Part of her was not surprised. She could only imagine the strain Marge must have been under these past weeks. Brenda, what can I do to help?
When I saw Marge before they took her in for surgery, she was so worried about Jamie. She asked if you could go over and be with him for a little while. Tell him everything will be all right. Maybe help him fix something for dinner. Marge is so worried that if anything happens to her now, who will be there for Jamie?
Tell Marge, of course I will. Please call me as soon as you get any updates on her condition.
I will, honey. Marge always told me how nice your family is and how lucky she is to have you as neighbors.
Aline said goodbye, disconnected, and immediately called Mike. She told him about Marge being in the hospital. I'm going over to spend some time with Jamie. Meet me later at the Chapman house.
Okay, but meet me outside. Remember, I'm not allowed to talk to Jamie anymore.
74. While driving to Valerie's home, Mike called Detective Angela Walker, who was also en route. He explained the sequence of events that began with finding Carrie in her family pool. Mike told her that he strongly believed something had happened at the breakfast the morning of Carrie's death that resulted in her sending Aline the very important text immediately afterward. There was a specific reason Mike had reached out to Angela. An African-American woman who had just turned 40, she had an extraordinary ability to push the right buttons to get young people to talk. He had personally observed her toughness in staring down an 18-year-old drug dealer during an interrogation, and her incredible compassion when talking to a 10-year-old boy who had witnessed his parents' murder. If there was a way to get Valerie to open up, she would find it. Marina Long greeted them at the door. She showed them into the den where Valerie was sitting up on a couch with two pillows behind her back and a blanket over her.
Wayne and I will be in the other room if you need us, Marina said as she left.
Mike and Angela settled in the two chairs opposite Valerie. Her eyes looked puffy and sad. After briefly making eye contact with him and Angela, she stared straight ahead.
Valerie, Mike said, let me begin by asking how you are doing.
I'm okay,
she said quietly.
This is Detective Angela Walker. She's working with me on the Carrie Dowling case.
Valerie continued to stare straight ahead.
Valerie,
Mike said,
I know that Carrie Dowling was your friend. I know how terrible it is to lose a friend. I'm sure that you want whoever hurt Carrie to be brought to justice.
She continued to stare off into the distance, but her face grew harder.
Valerie, at 11 o'clock in the morning on the day Carrie died, she sent a text to her sister Aline, who was in England at the time. Carrie said she had something very important to talk to her about. She sent that text right after she had breakfast at the Coach House Diner in Hackensack. Did you have breakfast with Carrie that morning?
No,
Valerie said, as she pulled the blanket higher, almost to her neck.
Valerie, the waitress at the diner was shown pictures of Carrie's friends. She identified you as the girl who was with Carrie.
Valerie shook her head back and forth as tears began to form in her eyes. Her breathing became heavier. Her hands were balled into fists. Mike was about to ask another question when he felt Angela's hand on his arm. He knew without being told that it was her signal that she wanted to take over.
Valerie, honey, would you mind if I sit with you on the couch? I like being close to people when I talk to them.
Without waiting for an answer, Angela moved to the couch.
Valerie slid over to make room for her.
That's better,
Angela said, facing Valerie from barely 2 feet away.
How old are you, Valerie?
16.
16, Angela said. I have a daughter who's 17. She's a lot like you. A pretty girl. Really good at sports.
What's her name?
Valerie asked.
Penelope.
She hates that name. Insists everybody call her Penny. She says Penelope is a clown's name. A faint trace of a smile came across Valerie's face. She's like you in another way, too. When she's got something bothering her, it's really hard for her to talk about it. She bottles things up inside her. Valerie looked away from Angela.
Valerie, honey, Angela said, I want you to look at me. Look right in my eyes.
Valerie turned her head back.
And I want to hold your hands. Is that okay?
Valerie nodded as Angela's hands enveloped hers.
Keep looking at me, honey. I know you have something terrible inside you. The only way things are going to get better is if you let it out.
Valerie shook her head.
Valerie, you're safe now. Whatever's hurting you or making you afraid, you can make it stop,
Angela said as she brushed aside a strand of hair that had fallen across the girl's face.
I can't,
Valerie whispered in a soft, almost childlike voice.
Yes, you can, honey. You don't have to be afraid anymore. You're safe now. You're safe.
Valerie's breathing became faster as tears filled both eyes.
It's okay, honey. You're safe.
He's raping me!
Valerie screamed and began to convulse in sobs as she fell into Angela's embrace. Aline hurried past the patio, through her backyard and around the hedges to Marge's property. It was an unusually cool, cloudy evening, and the sun was just disappearing below the horizon. Aline could see the light on in the upstairs room that she knew was Jamie's. Through an open window, she could hear the audio from a program he was watching. She rang the doorbell, waited, but got no response. Walking back into the yard, she shouted up to Jamie's room. He appeared at the window and said she could come up. As Aline ascended the stairs, she tried to remember that last time she had babysat her special neighbor. Almost 10 years ago, she thought. The force of Aline's knocks on Jamie's door was enough to open it. He was lying on his bed, staring at the ceiling. The TV was off now. As she looked at Jamie, it was clear that he had been crying.
My mom's in the hospital, he said. She went in the ambulance. She's gonna die and go to heaven with my dad.
Aline sat on the edge of the bed. Jamie, a lot of people who go to the hospital get better, and they come home. We have to hope and pray that your mom gets better, and that everything will be okay.
Mom is in the hospital because I'm bad. I'm going to jail because I did a bad thing. I went swimming with Carrie.
Tears began streaming down Jamie's face. His body shook as he cried softly.
Oh my God, Aline thought. He doesn't even understand what they think he did.
Aline ran her hands up and down his arms. Jamie's long, strong arms reached up and enveloped her in a hug. It was tight, almost painfully so. Despite what he was saying, she could not believe this gentle creature could have hurt Carrie. Was this an opportunity to find out what really happened to her sister? After giving him a moment or two to calm down, Aline stood up and went over to the window. The lights in her backyard had just come on and illuminated the murky twilight. Her mind returned to a psychology course she had taken in college. A particularly interesting lecture dealt with the strategy of having child victims reenact the traumas they had undergone as a way to cope with and master them. Was the night of Carrie's death a traumatic experience for Jamie? Had anyone asked him to relate what happened in a way that would allow him to tell the story? Jamie, have you had dinner yet?
No.
Is Chinese food still your favorite?
Sesame chicken, white rice, and wonton soup, Jamie said, a smile returning to his face.
Okay. I'm going to order Chinese food for you after we play a little game. We're going to pretend it's the night of Carrie's party.
They began with Jamie looking out the back window.
Carrie had a party, he said. Everybody went home, and Carrie was by herself.
So Carrie was alone. What was she doing?
She was cleaning up. Then Alan Crowley came over. He likes Carrie. He kissed her and hugged her.
Pointing to her backyard, Aline asked, "Where did Alan come from?" Jamie seemed confused by the questions. Aline took his hand. "Come on. We're going over to my yard. I want you to show me everything you did that night and everything you saw." For the full minute that Valerie cried, Angela held on as the girl buried her head in her shoulder.
"Who is it, Valerie?"
Angela asked.
"Who did this to you?"
"I can't tell. I told Carrie and she's dead. It's my fault."
Her voice had reached a crescendo of fear and grief. Angela began rocking her.
"Valerie. Valerie, you're safe, honey. You're safe."
Marina and Wayne had heard her screaming, "He's raping me," and rushed into the room.
"Valerie! Valerie!" Marina cried.
Mike was staring at Wayne. Aline had told him that Valerie seemed to resent her stepfather. Was he the one doing this to her? As Wayne rushed to Valerie, Mike sprang up. Wayne dropped to his knees beside the couch.
"Valerie, baby, tell us who did this to you. You need to tell us."
It's my coach, Scott Kimball. He did it. He won't stop."
"The coach," Marina exclaimed.
"My God, we let him come in here this afternoon. He was so concerned about Valerie, we even let him talk to her alone.
He warned me not to say anything to anybody. He said Aline should remember what happened to Carrie,"
Valerie sobbed. Wayne stood up.
"I'll kill him,"
he said, his voice deadly quiet. Mike was as dumbfounded as the others. Scott Kimball must have somehow found out that Valerie had confided in Carrie. He took out his cell phone, went to contacts, and tapped Aline's cell number. She didn't pick up.
"Is she in trouble?"
"I have to check on Aline," he said abruptly.
"Go," Angela said. "I've got things covered here."
He rushed out of the room, ran out the door, and to his car. As he was driving, he called the Saddle River police.
"Send units immediately to the Chapman House, 15 Waverly Road. Scott Kimball, white male, early 30s, a rapist and probably a murderer, might be there."
77. They walked downstairs, out the back door, and across the lawn. As they entered the Dowling property, Jamie stopped. He bent his head down and started walking around, looking at the grass.
"Jamie, what are you doing?"
"It's not here," he said.
"What's not here?" Aline asked.
"The golf club. It was on the grass."
"Wait here, Jamie."
Aline sprinted around to the garage, grabbed a club, brought it back to where Jamie was standing, and handed it to him.
"It was here,"
he said, putting the club in the grass, and then picking it back up.
"I wanted to help Carrie clean up."
"Show me what you did with it."
Jamie picked up the club and carried it over to the pool area. Looking at the end of the club, he said,
"This one is clean. The other one was dirty."
He put it on top of a recliner at the side of the pool.
So when Jamie picked up the club off the lawn and brought it to the pool area,
He believed he was helping to clean up, Aline thought. That explains why his fingerprints are on the murder weapon. She followed closely behind him. They were facing the patio.
You're doing a